And we are live. Welcome to another episode of Roasting Marshmallows. My name is Rolf Suut, and I am your host. Most people don't grow up learning very much about their emotions, what they are, how they work, or how to manage them well. This means that there are a lot of people out there with perfectly normal levels of academic or social intelligence, but very low or somewhat low emotional intelligence. Emotional intelligence means the capacity to reflect on and understand your emotional life. Because the clearer you can be about your emotions, what they are and how they work, the better you'll be able to manage the most difficult and painful ones. Thankfully, we can all improve our emotional intelligence with a little learning and some practice. This is important, not just for ourselves, but for our children as well. To help us improve, we have Mark Brackett on the show today. Mark is the founding director of the Yale Center for Emotional Intelligence and a professor in the Child Study Center, Yale School of Medicine at Yale University. His most recent book, Permission to Feel, explores ways for our emotions to help rather than hinder our well-being and success at home, in school, at work, and in everyday life. Welcome, Mark.
Thank you. Glad to be with you guys. Four guys talking about feelings. This is perfect.
Yeah, it's going to be
word is changing.
It's going to be great. I'm joined today by two regulars, of course, Arno and Henrique. Welcome, guys.
Thanks. Thanks. I'm looking forward for this conversation because, your bookmark basically, gave me the permission to feel. So I'm quite curious to, hear you from the questions that I have that
awesome.
Seem like there that couldn't get answered. Yeah.
So Mark, we've read a bit about your background in terms of like why you wrote the book, but can you maybe explain to the audience about like the uncle that you had and how it opened your eyes to get in touch with your emotions?
Sure. Well, as you know from, the opening of my book, I had a pretty tough childhood. There was abuse involved in my childhood. There was a lot of bullying involved in my childhood. And, you grew up thinking there's nothing you can do about this. Like you're powerless because an adult has power over you. And when there's lots of kids being mean or cruel to you, you're like, what can I do with this information?
Yeah.
I had two parents who loved me. That was clear. But, my mother was very anxious. And so she was always worrying about something and having her breakdowns. And so that was hard. I was like, well, if I, approach my mother with my issues, she's going to have another nervous breakdown. So, I'm not going to do that. And I had a father who was also a good guy, but he was, kind of this tough guy kind of mentality.
Right.
So like, son, you got to toughen up. And I realized, I don't think I'm a tough guy. So if I tell my, if I share what's happening to me, like I'm being bullied, my father's going to think I'm weak or he's just going to tell me to toughen up. And so what happens is that you are alone with all of those strong feelings.
Yeah.
And not great things happen. And so now to your real question is I was blessed to have an uncle who happened to be writing a curriculum to teach kids about their emotions.
Yeah.
And we built a relationship when I was around 11 and 12 years old, and he was the first adult that actually, really cared about how I was feeling. And he was the first adult that I shared everything I was going through with.
And that was such a profound experience for you that you actually, made a career out of it, basically.
It's interesting, of course, in a book, you can't go into my book's not about me. It's really about the work.
Yeah. Yeah.
But there's so many nuances, to what my relationship with my uncle, did to support me in healing.
Mm-hmm.
And also in having purpose in life.
Yeah.
Because I was confused about what I really want. I was going to be a teacher. I was going to be a lawyer. I was going to be an actor, a comedian. Now I feel like I'm all the above. So.
Yeah.
I'm a professor, so.
Right, and so, go ahead, guys.
I have one question.
Yeah.
So, I'm not sure if your father is still around, but did he actually see you go through this? Like, pursue this career?
He did. Initially, my father, when I told him I wanted to be a professor, he was like, you got to be kidding me. Yeah, they make crap money. Really?
Yeah.
And then, when I became a professor at Yale and I had this center that I created, you know, all of a sudden, you know, it was like, my son is a professor at Yale. Yeah. And so, you know, it's pretty interesting, you know, how you can, how people can, you know, shift their perspectives.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, sorry, did he approve to the subject or did he have an issue with it?
You know, it's interesting, you know, because I had a tough childhood, you know, it wasn't easy to talk to my father about feelings, although he was psychologically minded, you know, who's in therapy all the time.
Oh.
And so it's interesting, but I think he just was so afraid for his son, mm-hmm. you know, that in many ways, you know, he didn't know how to deal with it.
Yeah.
And he also didn't have any emotional intelligence training.
Yeah, so but, it goes back to his past as well.
Yeah, my father's upbringing was a nightmare. You know, his mother, my grandmother, had serious mental health issues. And so did, I think, my grandfather, you know. Yeah. And so what skills did my father learn about how to raise an emotionally intelligent child?
Yeah.
And is your uncle, like, the brother of your father or your mother?
My mother.
Yeah, okay.
So, yeah. So, you know, we're all parents here, at least Arno and me are. And I must admit that, at least for me, I'm kind of doing the same that your father did. Like, my son is 10 years old, and sometimes he's scared of going on the escalator without holding hands. And I tell him, like, you know, don't be such a baby. And, yeah. Well, maybe not that literally, but I try to teach him to, you know, in my way to become independent, I guess. And, and in your introduction, you mentioned that, you know, serious issues, occurred with, you know, that kind of upbringing. So am I damaging my son by doing this kind of stuff? And what kind of damage could I be causing?
Permanent brain damage.
Oh my God. Well, at least he has a brain then. That's good, right?
Just kidding. So a couple of things.
Yeah.
You know, first is, you know, what is the need that you have to say these things? You know, it's because it's nothing to do with your kid. It's all about you.
Right.
Right. Yeah. It's your fears. It's your insecurities, you know.
Yeah.
And so I think just being aware of that is really important. And then the second is, you know, you want your kid to grow up with self-esteem. You want your kid to grow up with confidence.
Yeah.
And so if you are endlessly saying things that make the kid feel inferior or not good enough or not skilled enough, like, it's just not helpful.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's better ways to communicate, you know, like maybe trying to understand where that fear is coming from.
Yeah.
And saying, let's talk through this. Let's think about the strategies that could be helpful.
But it's so hard, you know, if you look at... This stuff happens a lot, like during the day, and I don't know about you guys, but I'm always in a rush, and then boom, you're there. And I have three young kids, and then let's say the middle one goes off, whatever you call it, and then the other two are also pulling, like, come on, we'll go. And then you have to keep your calm, think about yourself, and then I think it's a struggle for me anyways.
I always say, like, how much time do you spend on social media, right? And how much time do you spend watching Netflix? How much time do you spend, you know, reading, you know, the news?
I'm actually very much below average on that. But
on all of those?
Yeah.
I'm sure that there are things that you do in your day, right, you know, where you're spending, you know, I don't know you, so I'm not saying that you're wasting your time. But I can tell you, it's like exercise, right?
Yeah.
Nobody has the time to work out. Not really true.
You know,
like, no, it's priorities, basically.
Well, right. It's making something it's valuable, you know, and, you know, whatever your career is, what is your career, actually, Arno?
I'm one of the agile coaches at Four Scouts. So as I mentioned before the podcast, we help companies, well, improve their processes, organization-wise or software-wise.
Right. So you're spending a lot of time probably thinking through solutions for other people.
Yeah.
You know, you could do a little bit more for yourself.
Well,
I agree.
you are here for a reason, so I'm already down that path.
Yeah, no, but like if we rotate, right? Because I totally agree with you on that. But let's say I have just maybe to give a little bit of context. Well, I didn't want to be a father, and I became a father. And well, now my son is 3 years old, and I did not know anything about emotions or feelings, right? I was one of those men that is basically would say, well, emotions is on my way to achieve whatever I need to achieve. So I cannot be constantly emotional, otherwise I can. So I was very much on that line of thinking. Don't ask me how I learned that, because I have no idea. And well, when he born, flipped the switch in my brain that kind of blocked me. And I don't know, there was like brain not talking to emotions. Mm-hmm. And that's when I came across your book. And it, I could understand like, oh, apparently I've been looking this the wrong way the whole time. Mm-hmm. And now he's three, mm-hmm. and he can communicate a little bit better. But mm-hmm. sometimes you just ask and they don't answer you. And then I think that the question is mostly like, then is there an age that you can start talking to kids that they finally understand, or not really?
The answer is that, you know, you can start this work before they're even conceived. Okay. You know, truthfully, you know, as a, we know from research that how kids experience, right, the womb affects their development. And so, you know, your wife or partner who, you know,
or ex
or whatever, the mother of your child, right, has feelings during pregnancy. Those feelings are, you know, are filtering through that child. Your energy, you know, around that, around the mother, around pregnancy affects the fetus. So, I mean, I don't mean to be so, you know, it really is true.
Yeah.
And so, you know, your facial expression, your body language, your vocal tone in infancy all create either a pleasant, comfortable emotional climate or a scary one.
Yeah. And how does that affect the child then, if it's in the womb? I don't get it. What does the research say? That there are more anxiety or more depressed?
Well,
or
it can affect it basically, you know, can impact their neural development. And so you're, if you are a mom who has, you know, greater levels of stress, those stress hormones are flooding through the blood system, right, of the entire body, and that baby's in that body. And so think about it in the worst scenario of alcohol, right? You know, alcohol syndrome. So that's an exaggerated example of a mother's behavior that could impact, you know, a child's development. Well, we tend to not think of psychology being as powerful as maybe alcohol, but mm-hmm. it can be.
Right.
So that basically brings me to the idea of like what I've did is wrong, right? So give me this guilt feeling of like, oh shit, I already damaged my kid.
Well, I've done this. I can't tell you when I do presentations, like I talk about, you know, the role, how bullying develops or really influences brain development. And mothers who are, or fathers who are mean and cruel to their kids say to me like, are you telling me I damaged my kid's brain? And I'm like, it definitely influenced your child's development.
Yep.
But the great news for all of us is that the brain is plastic and it's malleable. And so it's never too early to intervene. It's never too early to go from being the mean, cruel, critical to the caring, loving, compassionate.
Yeah.
Okay. That's good news indeed.
It is good news.
But a long path for yourself.
Yeah, I guess it starts there.
Yeah.
And is that also solely the parents' job? Because I can also imagine that schools have a huge part in this as well, because they, of course, see the children many hours per week as well.
Everybody's responsible.
Yeah.
Everybody's responsible. The bus driver's responsible.
Right.
The person who, if you have a nanny or, you know,
grandfather,
a babysitter, grandparents, everyone who interacts with the child, right, affects the development. I mean, think about my development. You know, a person who lived, you know, up the block from where I was, who mm-hmm. was the pedophile, dramatically changed my development. Mm. Yeah. You know, I didn't live with that person, but obviously the time I spent with that person had pretty serious implications for my...
Right. Exactly. And of course, we're talking about children a lot, but, you know, these people grow up and they, you know, hopefully get a job at one point and they land in a team somewhere in a company.
I'm looking at it.
Yeah, exactly.
Yes.
And well, my parents did not have your book, so maybe I should give my mother a copy. But, you know, because...
I don't know, man.
No, but at work, at work and at school, we talk a lot about results, right? We want, you know, we need grades, we need this diploma, we need, you know, the quarterly numbers to be met, right? So there's not a whole lot of room for you know, emotional intelligence at work. How do you start that conversation with, and with who? If you want to make a change.
Honestly, it starts at the top. And so, right, the CEO, the leader, the big boss needs to be someone who is comfortable with emotions. It will make a big difference.
Yeah.
You know, our center at Yale, we're a team of 60 people. And so, you know, the question is, a lot of people ask me this, like, can you like really share how you're feeling these days with your team?
Mm-hmm.
And I say, I try to be as honest as I can be, but not in a way that makes people think that the center is going to crumble, right? Or that, you know, I can't handle, you know, my feelings. So there's a big difference as a leader or a manager walking into a team meeting saying, I'm having a breakdown. I can't take it anymore. I think the world's going to come to an end. The stock market's crashing. Everybody's working from home. I don't trust anybody's doing their work.
Yeah.
It's like, oh, crap. Like,
yeah.
Mark's losing it. I'm going to get another job. As opposed to, you know, I don't know if you've read the newspaper, but Omicron seems to be, you know, really spreading fast.
Yep.
And
yep.
I think we need to be super careful. And it makes me nervous to be out in the world right now. And so I'm taking a break from traveling and I want to really protect myself and my family. And I encourage all of you to do the same.
Yeah.
Big difference, right? In terms of like, making everybody activated versus communicating how you're feeling, as well as communicating the strategy that you're using to manage the feeling. To me, that's the critical piece, is that you don't just share the feeling, you share out loud mm-hmm. what your effective strategy is.
So, because in your book, you create this, well, I think you use the word framework, right? The ruler.
Yeah.
Thing. And so would you say then from the CEO point of view, he would go through all this ruler stage, like the recognition, understanding, labeling, expressing, and then he would basically do this whole work himself before he would express this to the people?
It's always interpersonal. It's always self and other. The whole set of skills are both individual and collective. Right. So it's how am I feeling? How are you feeling right now? Right. Mm-hmm. It's like, how do I feel being on this, you know, webcast with three strangers from the Netherlands? Yeah. You know, I'm not going to share how I feel about that right now. And then, you know, how are the three of you feeling, you know, about, you know, interviewing me?
Mm-hmm.
Do I understand my feelings? Why am I having this feeling? Do I understand why you're feeling the way you're feeling? Am I using the right language? And then the question is, am I managing? Like if I were anxious right now, what would be my strategy for managing my anxiety?
Yeah.
If I noticed that you guys were nervous interviewing me, what would be my strategy to help make you feel less nervous? So leaders, parents, teachers, anyone, right, who's interacting with people are always going through this kind of back and forth with emotion.
Yeah.
Whether you're conscious of it or not.
Right.
But I think the part that, like, say, at least for me, right, I discovered your book, I think already 2 years ago. And basically for me, I don't have the tools, the techniques I didn't learn when I was 11, right? So when I read, oh, you have to recognize, and I went to, for example, to a psychologist, and psychologist, yeah, just tell me how you feel, like, What do you mean? I don't really know how to even look at it. Like, mm-hmm. And some of them just say, look at your feet. They're like, what do you mean, look at my feet? Yeah, you have to look inside. So I think the part that is very hard is like, how do you even learn to recognize that there's something going on if you never did for, 30 years, that's my case.
I mean, this is why, you know, my work is developmental, because, you know, how you teach this and learn this in preschool is different than elementary or, you know, primary school, then middle school, then high school, then college, and the workplace. Because right, I didn't have to manage a team when I was in kindergarten.
Yeah.
But, you know, now I do. You know, I wasn't married when I was in middle school. Now I am.
Yeah.
And it's a different context, and the skills are more complex as you develop. So this is why I feel like we need to start early and kind of build upon, you know, the skills.
Yeah, so I have to somehow, like, figure it out how to learn that, basically. Mm-hmm. That's what I understand.
Well, you manage, right? I mean,
don't know.
You might not be be there yet, but pretty sure you're making progress. So
I think sometimes I do, and sometimes I just know that there is something going on, but I have no idea.
Yeah.
Like, I just can't understand it. I cannot label it. I cannot, even dream of expressing it.
Right. It's just there.
Something is there.
I wrote my book, right? So
yeah,
I'm trying to help. You know, that's the beginning of your journey. Is like reading a book and reflecting on it. Obviously, even doing these kinds of conversations helps to make it deeper.
Yeah.
But then you can go further. You know, this is why I actually started a company a couple of years ago called OG Life Lab, because I would do all these presentations for companies, and they'd say, like, well, how do we go deeper? And, you know, it's not Mark doing 500 workshops for the company, right? It's helping the employees really build the skills over time and get
to,
because coaching and feedback is important for this.
Yep.
Yeah.
You know, like, we're not that self-aware, you know, we tend to be a little bit, we tend to overestimate, you know, our skills. You know, like, I'm a leader. Like, of course I can read people well. It's like, guess what? I can't tell you how many, like, managers and leaders I've met that say, you know, there's one thing I'm certain of, Mark, it's my emotional intelligence. I'm like, there's one thing I'm certain of is you are not self-aware.
Yeah.
I can agree with that.
So what do you advise them then? Police.
I mean, the thing is, how could you be self-aware about something you don't even know anything about, right? Yes. And so my other career that you, I don't know if you know, is I was a martial arts instructor for 25 years. And so I have a 5th degree black belt in a martial art called Hapkido.
Yep.
It's a Korean martial art.
I don't know what it is.
It's a Korean martial art, essentially, that teaches, you know how to twist wrists and break elbows and crack neck.
Yeah, yeah.
all those good things. The reason why I like to use it as a parallel is that, you know, there's requirements for a yellow belt, a blue belt, a black belt. And you got to practice, you got to refine, you get evaluated. We don't really have that for emotional intelligence. There's no criterion.
No.
There's no, feedback.
Yeah.
That's not really something you can measure, is it? You just can't measure it.
You can. We've been working on that, actually. So there are ways to measure.
And is that something you implement then at companies?
We have worked with companies on this. It's not about, like, your self-report, though, right? Like, if I ask you, like, how good are you at reading faces?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Really doesn't have very much meaning.
Mm-hmm.
But if I show you 25 facial expressions and videos and ask you, what emotion do you think that person is experiencing?
Yeah.
And you
Okay.
think all happy people are angry, right? Then we got a problem.
Yeah. But it can also be a state of mind, right? Because I read somewhere that like if you're in a depression state, then you tend to see things a bit more negative as well. So that makes, I think,
you probably read that in my book, just saying.
Okay, then it wasn't your book. But, I mean,
it's not my research. But yes, our mood state, how we feel, biases the way we see the world.
Yeah.
For the good and the bad, right? So your three-year-old or five, how old is your child still three?
Yeah, three, yeah.
Yeah. So they're starting to talk and, you know, want things for Christmas. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, they're going to want daddy to be in a good mood, right? Because daddy's going to buy them more stuff. If daddy's irritable or angry or overwhelmed, you know, daddy's less likely to buy good stuff for them. And so mood can bias things. And we, you know, we tell people, great job, even though it's not even that great because we're in a good mood. We're overly critical, right? When we're irritable.
Yeah.
And like, how do you see, like, for example, and that's a part that I also found a bit hard on this process of, let's say, understand the emotions and feelings. And in your book, you do explain actually the difference between feelings and emotions. And I think I read three times that part and I keep not knowing the difference between feelings and emotions. I had this experience at work, right? We are all sitting, we are having an important meeting. It was not you guys, so be okay with
it. It's okay, man.
And and then eventually we have to make a decision. We are like tight in time and somebody just start crying in the middle of the whole thing. And then we try to be, you know, supportive and we talk and we listen. But eventually the decision still needs to be made. And then we are all there sitting, everybody have no idea what to do. And then what would your advice to be in that situation? Like, yeah, do we comfort the person? Do we ask the person to leave? I found this so weirdly hard.
Give me a specific scenario.
Yeah. So that person had to make a choice, right? Like there was A, B, and C, and then was the boss was there. We were there as coaches and there was a bunch of other developers. And then the guy was a bit pushy, right? Like, hey, we need this to be done. We need this to be done as soon as possible. And I think she felt a little overwhelmed. And then she just cracks down and cried. And then everybody started looking at each other and like, okay, what do we do now?
Go.
And nobody did anything.
Yeah, that's because everybody's afraid of the feelings, right?
Yes.
And so
I was totally terrified by it. I honestly didn't have a clue.
You know, I would say something like, you know, it's pretty clear we have some strong feelings, you know, in the room right now. How about we take a 10-minute break? Everybody get a drink of coffee, a glass of water or something like that. And, you know, I want to check in with the team and then we'll come back. And then you go up to this person there's a guy who is being kind of too strong. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
And just say, you know, I'm just curious, like, what's going on? You know, what made you kind of react that way? Or, you know, oh, I can't take it. You know, and you got to learn. You got to be the learner. You know, that's my theory. Be in learning mode. Be the compassionate. Chapter two, right?
Yes.
The compassionate emotion scientist, not the critical judge. You know, and then also you have to set boundaries, you know, and say, you know, obviously it didn't land well with this woman. And so we need to figure out a way to make this person feel more comfortable in the meeting. And
for example, if in the example you gave before, right? Let's say if she would apply your framework with the ruler, and then eventually, let's say this whole process would have to happen extremely quick.
It does, yeah.
But for me, that process takes days, for example. Like,
because you're not practiced. It's like, you know, it's like, again, going back to the martial arts, like running up in the air and doing a flying sidekick, you know, is not hard for someone who's practiced it for 10 years. And so this is a muscle. This is not easy.
Oh, man. That's the bad news.
Yeah, I didn't want to hear that.
I'm sorry. It is what it is.
Yeah.
You know, and it's like, you got to be comfortable failing at it and just say it up front. Yeah, and it's work. It's effort.
And did you notice any cultural differences on this, like on confidence, where they where you should respond differently, or there's no difference?
There's differences, not major ones. I mean, you guys seem pretty normal to me.
We're trying.
Yes, I take that as a compliment.
It was after reading your book, by the way.
Of course, I take all the credit. you know, I think what the research would show in terms of the real difference, it's in kind of the cultural rules around expressing. And so, you know, if you're from Italy, you know, Marco, you know, I love going to Italy. Everybody kisses me all the time.
I don't know, man. Omicron? I don't know.
Yeah. You know, you go to Asia and there's no kissing. It's bowing, or, you know, and so it's not as if bowing is bad and kissing is good, or kissing is bad and bow, you know.
Yeah.
It's like that mindset around the judgment of the behavior for how we greet people needs to just be thrown away. Again, we enter it as the curious emotion scientist saying, oh, it's interesting. People here behave this way, behave that way. I wonder why they do that.
Yeah.
I think what the research would argue is that people's experience of emotion is pretty universal. Like, have you ever felt jealous of another guy?
Yeah,
of course.
Yeah. You know, have you ever felt envious of something someone else had that you didn't have?
Yeah.
Ever felt overwhelmed at work?
Baby, yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Disappointed in your own progress towards a goal?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anxious about what's going to happen with business?
Sometimes.
Yeah.
Yeah, of course. Yeah.
And so, like, guess what, guys? You're like every other guy. Sorry. You have other things that you can be unique about, your creativity. But, you know, we're all human beings that are built to have feelings. The question is, you know, how aware are we of our feelings and how well do we regulate them? And I think, you know, too many people, as you said, I think, Rolf, in your intro, think that it's all about performance and academics and cognition.
Mm-hmm.
But, you know, as a person who works at a very, you know, a high powered university with people with very high academic intelligence,
mm-hmm.
I was under the assumption, you know, that every one of my students was going to be brilliant. And every one of them was going to achieve their dreams in life and, you know, become the senator or the CEO or the billionaire. You know, and so many students don't achieve their dreams. And it's a lot of times because they don't have emotional intelligence.
Really?
Because they don't deal well with feedback and they get completely angry at the feedback or disappointed in the feedback or overwhelmed by it.
And then they just give up or...
Exactly.
Yeah, yeah.
Or they're doing something creative and they get feedback that's like, you know what? This could be more creative. Like, you're not pushing yourself hard enough. And they're like, go blank yourself. Who do you think you are giving that feedback? I know how creative I am. Yeah. And so if you're not open to feedback, if you're not willing to work collaboratively on a team, I think oftentimes life is not as easy for you, even if you have the perfect scores in every standardized test.
Yeah.
Yeah, so that's the emotional part. So I didn't know that categorizes an emotional intelligence. But that's changeable, right? As you said, so the brain is plastic, these people can learn.
Of course.
Yeah. It is, but the thing is that, you know, unfortunately, you know, in at least American culture, when you're brought up in a family that only nurtures your academic skills, then you get to become a student of mine. And I say, guess what? You know, like there are other skills that you're going to need to really succeed. Well, I got into Yale. You know, I've had students say things like, I didn't need emotional intelligence to get into Yale. And I say, well, guess what? You're going to need those skills to get out.
Yeah.
And I say that jokingly, but at the same time, I mean it because... Yeah. I mean, have you ever worked for someone who didn't have emotional intelligence?
Yes, yeah. Probably.
It's not the most enjoyable experience.
No.
No.
Dismissive, doesn't really care about your life experiences, you know, very black or white about things.
So, and
then, yeah, go ahead.
Where does this come from? That's what I'm wondering. Is this something culturally just grows from, I don't know, pain in the past? Or is it...
Where does the lack of emotional intelligence come from?
Yeah.
I think it comes from biology and nurture, meaning that we like immediate gratification as people. And so, and we want to avoid confrontation. And so we want pleasure and we want to avoid pain. And so I think what happens is that through life, we learn what's the easiest way to avoid pleasure or to gain pleasure and avoid pain. Oh, alcohol.
Yeah.
That's easy. I don't have to do anything. I can just drink and all of a sudden I don't have to feel the pain and I can get the pleasure.
Yeah.
Avoidance. That's easier. I can avoid the pain. Addiction. Oh, that's easy. I don't have to just keep on doing the drugs. Whereas all of the strategies that help us to build and maintain healthy relationships and make good decisions, it's like, you know, you got to pause, you got to reflect, you got to spend time thinking about it. I was just working with one of my team members who's having some trouble on a team. And he's like, I just want to tell people, you know, I want to just give them the feedback. And I said, I know that, but do you want them to continue working with you? And so, like, if you want to just, you know, rip someone's work to shreds, go for it. You know, you'll feel better that you made all the changes that were better according to your perspective. But no one's going to want to work with you.
Yeah.
So it takes effort to give constructive feedback so that people grow as opposed to feel like they are unsupported.
Because a few minutes ago, we talked about this idea of you need to be open or emotionally intelligent to be able to receive feedback. But then there is also the other side of it, that the person who is giving it has to know how to do it, right?
100%.
Or also has to have emotional intelligence to give it or not.
Definitely, because... I mean, feedback is an art form, you know, and so I think most people don't give feedback because of emotion. They fear the response of the recipient.
For sure.
Or they don't know how to skillfully do it, so they just are, it's easier to avoid. Easier in the short run. It's so much harder in the long run, though, when you know, because once the challenging behavior, let's say on a team, metastasizes, it's a lot harder to fix. So I really feel like we need to teach people how to give emotionally intelligent feedback early on. And that means that it's about understanding your feelings during that process and understanding the other person's feelings and trying to figure out the strategy that's going to be most helpful to achieve the outcome.
What kind of strategies could you apply? Like, let's say after a day of work, things hasn't going very well maybe, and I'm a bit depressed. What would be a strategy, for example, to deal with that at that point in time? Like, are there a few, you know, is it different for everyone, or are there also a few strategies that are universally applicable? Probably not drinking a nice cold one after work. It's probably not the best strategy, but I think a lot of people opt for that.
I'm not judging. I love a good glass of wine.
Yeah.
It's after the fourth that, you know, it's like a little
problem. Yeah, it might be a problem.
So you're talking about just like rough day at work and you're transitioning home and you're feeling a little down.
Yeah.
Or you're talking about in the process of giving feedback.
Well, like I said, you were mentioning like, okay, I'm getting feedback from someone, or maybe I am noticing myself that I'm having a particular emotion. And then you said like, oh, there might be some strategies in order for you to deal with the emotion or to channel it in a more positive way, not, you know, something like that. So I was just wondering, like, what kind of strategies would that be?
Firstly, it's permission to feel, right? It's all good. There's no judgment.
Right.
I think, you know, if it's a strong, unpleasant emotion where you're activated, like anxiety or fear or something like that, you got to do some down-regulation strategies, some breathing exercises, right? Something to just decrease the physiological activation that's putting you in that kind of like fight, flight, freeze mode. Really important. It's not the end all be all. Some people think, you know, if I breathe, everything's going to be fine. No. It's one pathway towards healthy regulation.
Yeah.
The other is really important, which is having an understanding of your self-talk. You know, so many of us are self-saboteurs. We're self-critics.
Yeah.
I'm too fat. I'm too skinny. I'm a terrible father. You know, I'm a terrible boss. Nobody likes me. I never get, nothing ever works right for me. Again, easy to develop that negative self-criticism. And so how do you pause and say, Mark, you're working, you're leading a team of 60 during this pandemic. You're really putting in all the effort possible. You're doing the best you can. And you know what? That's good enough. It's good enough. You're not going to, no one can be a superhero during these times. It's really hard. Or you get into a fight with your partner and you feel awful and you say to yourself, you know, really, why was I so activated by that? Know, like, is this thing that I'm so pissed off about right now, am I really going to not sleep about it tonight? Or is it just like, well, if it is, right, then you have to figure out a different solution. But that you have to ask questions, right? You know, because some of the stuff that I complain of, like for me, my partner is not as conscientious as I am about like buying things. So like, I'm very like, I could tell you what I paid for, like the chair that I'm sitting in 10 years ago. I just have that brain. And my partner is not, does not have that brain. And so I'm like, how much did it cost? I don't know. What do you mean? How could you? I don't mean you. How do you, what do you mean you don't know? Like, you actually, remember you gave the credit card and you signed the thing? Like, did you look at it? I did, but you know, whatever. And then, all right, so that's been a problem. We've been together 27 years. And so far, like, memory of what things cost has not improved. But the other news is that we're not broke. And, you know, so like, I mean, if we were like $25,000, I might have a complete, you know, freak out. But like, do I need, like, you see what I'm saying? It's like, is that a fish that I need to fry? Or do I just let that fish go back in the water and just say, you know what? This is agreed to.
But it you took know, you a few, right? It took a few incidents, I guess, for you to really realize, like, you know what? This is just how it is.
That's 25 just, years.
Yeah, exactly. So that's
still going on.
And if I, if like, and if the stock market is going down that day, and if I'm in a bad mood, it's a nightmare. And so then I'm like, Mark. And that's that. Then you have to recognize, going back to strategies. Mark, you are responding this way today because it's a rainy day. Because you think the world is coming to an end because the stock market has gone, the stock market has gone down a few hundred points. The stock market has been going up and down since its inception.
It's going to be fine.
You got to let go because you have no control over it.
Yeah.
So like allowing dip in the stock market to have power over how you treat your partner. Like, come on. That's pretty freaking ridiculous.
Oh boy.
But do you all relate to me? Do you relate to me like, like a deal at
100%. But it definitely takes some discipline to be able to have that conversation with yourself in the heat of the moment, right? But I guess, you know, it circles back to the point of, you know, 10 years of Hapkido training, right? You just have to keep on doing this kind of stuff to be able to.
But so you got to, prevention is better than intervention.
Yeah.
So the more you know about how you're likely to respond and the emotions that you're going to have, the better prepared you'll be. And so It's like if you drive to work and you've had this like shitty day, before you enter your house, you sit in your car for 3 minutes and take some breaths and say, how am I going to enter into this house being the best possible husband?
Yeah, I actually do that now. I just wait a few minutes before I go in. That actually helps. But I was wondering, prevention is better. I get that. But did you ever research on meditation, for example? Like people that meditate every day?
Yeah, there's plenty of good research on that. I think, you know, what the meditation does is similar to the breathing, is that it helps us with lots of things. It can help us kind of just feel generally less anxious and overwhelmed, less stressed out. It can help us be more present, you know, which is important, like just being more present-minded. I tend to be very ADD. I mean, my brain is like, I'm always in the future. I'm always thinking about like what's next.
Yeah.
And so the meditation can say, you know, help me be, you know, a better participant on a podcast like this. What meditation probably won't do is like save your marriage. Right? Yeah. If you're not happy with like things that you and your husband, partner, your wife do, like you got to work through the problem.
Yeah.
And that's not, you can't just meditate the problem away.
No. Shit.
Sorry.
Yeah.
You could avoid it. And I think some people use meditation as a form of avoidance, actually.
Yeah. Yeah.
I think it's just a coping mechanism. Oh, isn't it just a coping mechanism then? Because if I'm irritated, I say that out loud in the end. Because otherwise it just grows, and then, well, you become close to hatred, I think.
Well, you're not doing the ruler. If you're doing the ruler, you probably would do different.
Yeah, so, I mean, this is why, you know, emotion regulation, by the way, this is my next book that I'm working on, is putting all these things together for people. Because I think that we get over-reliant on one strategy, like mindfulness seems to be like everything right now. Everybody's mindful.
Yeah.
Meanwhile, I mean, I meet some people who have studied mindfulness for 50 years and they're like the meanest people I've ever met. it's like, wait a minute, like you didn't even say hello to me in the hallway. And so I think that we overemphasize single strategies as being the answer. So there's permission to feel. There's mindfulness and breathing exercises. There's the self-talk strategies.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Right? Like, what is the story you say to yourself when you fail? I'm an idiot. I'm a loser. Or, you know what? Everybody makes mistakes. Mark, you know what? Give yourself a break.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Then there's the social strategies, surrounding yourself with the people that bring you joy and comfort.
Yeah.
I have to tell you, for years, I tried to be around people that I didn't even like because I thought it was important.
Mm.
And then I'm like, why am I doing this? I'm not my true self with these people.
Yeah.
And so, I mean, do you have a relative, like an aunt or an uncle or a teacher or a friend or a brother or a sister or somebody that just, whenever you're with them, you just feel more at ease?
Yeah. Yeah. Very much.
Yeah.
And I also have the opposite.
Yeah.
Right. And so, but, you know, the prevention scientist says, I'm going to spend the holidays with the people who make me feel content, not the people who make me agitated.
Yeah.
All
right. Go ahead.
Yeah. So I do wonder this, right? Like, for example, because you mentioned a few times in this episode, something like I don't judge. Is there a place for judgment on any of this at some point? As let's say with a friend or with a relative or with your partner doing something that you don't like, in a way you judge or don't. And when I think about, let's say, if I have a relative or a friend or colleague that I dislike or doesn't bring me easy, isn't it also my responsibility to try to help that person to become a bit more, I don't know,
self-aware?
Or self-aware? Yeah. Or
it depends. You know, like, you can't be responsible for everybody else's behavior because that's going to drive you crazy.
Yeah.
You know, I went down that route many times and, you know, if someone has a personality disorder, stay away. and you're not going to change their behavior, right? It's too complicated. You know, I have an aunt, you know, she was in her late 60s, 70s, and everything was like, she was so judgmental, you know? And my, I realized in the end that I just had to stay away from this relative because, you know, she was very set in her ways. Now, at the same time, I also needed to have the courage to give this person feedback about the way they treated me and other people. And that was the hard part, saying, you know, God, when you say these things to my brother, like, it really doesn't feel good.
Sounds a bit like the boundary book.
Yeah.
So we've been talking a lot about, you know, that emotions are, you know, okay to have, that you have permission to feel. And, you know, I think I already know the answer, but I'm going to ask the question anyway. So are there situations where it is necessary to maybe disregard emotions entirely? Like, let's say, you know, something like on the scale of a 9/11 disaster, or you're a, you know, a soldier in war, you know, fighting for your life. Right, we have the pandemic now with Omicron. You know, yeah, would there be places where it's okay to say, like, nope, there's no permission to feel right now, we need to get through this crisis first and then we can deal with emotions later? Is that ever okay?
I think it's about the framing of it. I think that you can still give yourself the permission to feel and not allow the feeling to have power over you,
right?
You know, sometimes you do want to compartmentalize. You know, I'll give you the example. Like when my dad died, it was the day before I had to do this big keynote presentation at a conference. And so I had to decide, you know, if I canceled it, it was going to look really bad because I was the only presenter.
Mm-hmm.
It was in like a big hotel in New York City. Like, oof, that's not going to go so well.
Yeah.
At the same point, I was feeling tremendous loss and grief and sadness. Third, I was thinking, you know, my father, was like a worker. And he would have said to me, Mark, you get up and like, what are you going to sit around and you're going to sit around and cry about me? Get up on that stage and do that presentation, make some money. and so, you know, when I did the talk, I had to make a choice and I decided to put my grief and sadness in a box for 2 hours.
Yeah.
And it worked fine. And I, you know, I did some little things during my presentation, like in terms of like thinking about my dad, but in a beautiful, nostalgic, positive way.
Yeah.
I didn't go into the whole story about how my father had died the day before, cause I didn't think that would be, the audience might think, God, this guy's like, you know,
chatting too much.
And so it's like, basically there's a lot of discernment in this work. You know, and a lot of contextualization. And, you know, I also knew that when I had to do this talk that I brought my brother with me. And I like, so I had like someone in the audience that I could just like check in on.
Yep.
That kind of was my stability.
Yeah. But he was not crying there.
No, he got mad at me because I actually, you know, talked about my childhood and how my parents, you know, were emotionally not the best and, you know, would scream and yell. And I watched my brother like freaking out in the audience.
Oh, I think story is also from the book, isn't it? I think I
remember. It is. Yeah. Yeah. They were like, they were so angry with me that I was, you know, talking about my dysfunctional childhood. But that was, you know, that's my strategy.
Right.
I think that's a question I have then. Like, how is for your relatives then? Do you feel guilty that you tell the stories about that, let's say, for example, from your father, your mother? Because normally when I share those stories here, I feel guilty for my parents somehow. Like, oh, if they listen to this, and if they don't, I would feel like extremely weird about it.
I mean, to be fully honest with you, you know, both my parents passed away, so I felt like I could say whatever I wanted.
But your brother's still there.
And I also decided, and I also, believe me, if I would have shared everything about my brothers, they would have just, I wouldn't be on this podcast right now. I really was like super careful about, you know, I'm not going to disrespect my brothers.
Yeah.
And say things about, you know, their lives. It's their private lives. It's not for me.
Exactly.
The judge. I mean, I do judge them enormously, but I don't need to make that public. But I think, you know, it's interesting. Like, can you, I mean, people have, you know, Freud actually said that, that people may not ever be able to be their full authentic selves until their parents are no longer with them.
So do you agree? Is,
meaning when they're dead or when you move out from house?
No, when they're gone. I mean, we probably don't want to end the podcast on this.
No, no.
Probably not.
I don't know, actually.
So, Mark, now you have the responsibility to turn the tone.
I know. Like, what did I just get myself into? Actually, you know, all the things that I did say in my book about my parents, we talked about. I was very open with my father. And my father, interestingly enough, as he grew older, deeply appreciated this work and understood its value.
Well, that's nice. Yeah.
Yeah.
For sure.
And my mother too. My mother died very young. You know, and I often think, you know, my mother didn't have a good emotion education. She grew up in a very neurotic family. And like, I feel, you know, I just wish, you know, I feel in many ways my mother didn't get to reach her full potential because of her inability to deal with her stress and anxiety and fear.
Yeah.
And so, you know, one of the things that I'll say that's maybe also a little off, you know, no, is that okay. You observing my mother, for example, and her frustration with some aspects of her life motivated me, right, to not replicate that lifestyle.
Yep.
Like, I don't want to end up having all these regrets, or I don't want to end up not achieving my goals in life. And so what do I need to learn? What strategies do I need to develop, right, to ensure that my dreams come true?
Yeah, for sure. I think at least I can agree on that one, that I don't want to make some of the same mistakes that my parents did. So at least, you know, I'm very, how do you say, that I'm aware of certain choices that, that my parents made that I don't want to make, and or at least different ones. So at least, you know, I'm trying to keep that going. So to maybe end on a positive note here.
Okay.
So you mentioned that you're working on a new book, but also before we started this podcast, you mentioned that your Permission to Feel book is actually going to get released in Dutch for all of our Dutch listeners here. And Hiek, that's going to probably be a problem for you, but God you already read the book in its pure form. Maybe a Portuguese translation will hit the market soon as well.
My book is already out in Portuguese.
There we go.
It's
I need to give to my parents.
Permissão para sentir.
Yeah.
All right. So
that is it.
Yeah. So be on the lookout for that one. Mark, I don't know if you have anything left to add for the audience, or anything you still want to say.
You know, I have to say, you know, I wasn't sure how this was going to go. It's fun to talk with three guys about feelings.
Yeah.
I feel like we should go. Maybe we can go on the road and do a whole thing on this.
Yeah, for sure.
I'm a bit scared to do that. Man.
It's okay. Look at it. Do the whole ruler thing. Well, on my note, I would like to thank you a lot, because your book indeed, and this is not like just words, it did change me. It was changing like the partner that I have right now. And then I asked this guy to read, and they all read, and now basically changed the way how we work.
Yeah.
It created a lot of problems on that too, because now we don't know how to deal with a lot of things, but it definitely opened a door for me that, thanks for that. Thanks for your work. It is pretty nice.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. And, you know, maybe when my book comes out in Dutch, I can come visit you guys over. Where are you based? Where are you based in the Netherlands?
Well, we're in Utrecht, but we can be anywhere. The country is so tiny.
I think I've actually been to that town. Is there a university there?
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I might even have somebody who I used to train, who worked with me, that's a professor there.
Okay.
And then I've been to, what's that other town?
Amsterdam.
No, I've been to Amsterdam, but it's another one.
With a university? With an O.
Yeah.
Rotterdam?
With an O.
With an O?
Which one?
Rotterdam? Or starts with an O?
No. I don't know. It's well, no, it's under by the water.
Oh, man. That's the whole country.
Yeah.
Delft, man. Drive me crazy now. Yeah.
Well, we can, but I gotta say, I'm anyway. Pretty pleased it's gonna be in Dutch, to be honest. I think my wife would like it a lot. Because for me, it was like, I think it's okay English, but I know a lot of people it's a bigger issue. So if it's in Dutch, pretty cool.
Yeah.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I'm excited for it to come out.
Yeah. If you ever come by Holland, of course, man, you're welcome. I think it's great.
And when your new book is there, please come back.
Yes.
Yeah.
I appreciate that. And, I hope you have a great holiday break. Do you celebrate the holidays in the Netherlands?
Yes, yeah. We do. Yeah, it's going to be
great.
So. Hopefully, even the weather is getting a bit colder, so I don't know if it's going to be a white Christmas, but there might be a chance here. So it's looking good.
Cool.
So, Mark, thank you very much. I also want to thank the listener, of course, for tuning in. If you have any questions, feel free to send us an email at podcast@4scouts.nl. We are also on Twitter. That's @4scouts. Mark, can people reach you maybe if they have any questions or remarks on Twitter or anywhere else? No? Unreachable?
No, I'm kidding. I don't talk to people. I can't stand people.
Yeah.
I think I'm on Twitter, which is my name, Mark Bracken. I'm on Instagram. I'm also, my website has all the information about my book, which is www.markbracket.com.
All right. We'll include that in the description here.
Thank you.
Thank you very much, guys. See ya. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye, everybody.